Hello, and welcome to The Slow Revolution, the podcast where we explore the pros and cons of slowing down in a fast and impatient world. I'm Carl Honoré, your host, and today we're going on a road trip to the north of England, to a post-industrial town called Blackburn. We're not going to tour the old Victorian mills or to watch the Blackburn Rovers play football. Instead, we're going to visit St. Silas Church of England Primary School. Why? Because when people look for examples of slow education working in the real world, St. Silas is often top of the list. When it comes to judging a school, exam scores only ever get you so far. I think the best measure is to walk around the school itself and see what it actually feels like. Are the children happy and engaged? Can you hear laughter? Do pupils and staff treat each other with respect? Does it feel like real learning is going on? Does the building itself lift the spirits? And most important of all, would I want my own children to come here? After touring St. Silas, my answer to all these questions was a resounding yes. So I was excited to sit down for a chat with the two people who did the most to reinvent St. Silas as a beacon of slow education. First, Hilary Hinchliffe, the head teacher at the time of recording. She spearheaded the move to bring slow education to St. Silas. Sitting alongside her in the interview was Chris Boyce, the architect who designed and built the school with input from Hinchliffe and her team of slow educators. So let's jump in. The next thing you'll hear is Hilary Hinchliffe talking about what slow education means to her.
Every opportunity to learn in the way that they choose to learn and what they want to learn. And that sometimes comes across as sounding very unstructured, but actually there is quite a lot of structure to that. And I think we as educators and architects have to ensure that the school is structured in a way that gives the children that opportunity to be really engaged, independent learners. And we've worked very, very hard at that. We did start on this process before we had the new school. We had a very old school. It wasn't fit for purpose, but we tried to make it as good as it could be. We are lucky enough to have had a new school built, and working with the architects made a really big difference to what we can actually provide for the children. But it started some years ago when I first came to the school and found that my four-year-olds in reception were more independent and engaged learners than the 11-year-olds in year six. And it just seemed nonsensical to me that that was the case. So we took the elements that were working really, really well in reception, and we took continuous provision all the way through from reception to year six. Obviously, it looks very different in year six how it looks in reception, but there are those certain elements that go all the way through school.
Can I just ask you to explain continuous provision and what that means to listeners who maybe are new to that term?
Right. So in foundation, in reception classes, you would find in just about every classroom in this country, open areas where resources are left out for the children to actually take and use as they want. And teachers will work with children, adults will work with children, but when they're not working with the adults, children can go and choose in the different areas and they can take their learning whichever way they want to go. So that's been in place for reception classrooms for an awful long time. What we found was when they went into year one, which was quite formal, sat at a table, pen and paper, set lessons, that the children's learning actually plateaued. So we took continuous provision and took it into year one, and we found actually that the results went up. So having areas in the classroom, having all the resources out, having some prompts there for ideas for children if they get stuck, but predominantly children choosing their own learning journeys. The results, as I say, rose, so we took it into year two. We had the best SATS results that school has ever had. Year three, four, and five, six teachers saw the writing on the wall. Mm. We worked together as a school. We did take it slowly, which goes back to the slow education thing. And we started taking elements of it all the way through school. So in Key Stage 2, it is a project-based learning approach. But we have it open to the children for the majority of the day. So I think a lot of schools have done projects where they do it in the afternoon. We decided not to go down that route. We have it available all the way through the day. So slow education for us is a variety of things. It's ensuring that the children have an opportunity to have real depth in their learning. So if they're really interested in something, rather than having to stop it because you're at the end of a session or an end of a lesson or not doing that topic anymore, it's giving them opportunities where they can stop and start, they can go back to it, they can spend 2 solid days on it if they're really, really interested. And we look very much at levels of engagement. Are the children engaged in their learning? We also look at their learning progress. So looking at the beginning of the year, can you actually see an improvement in the work by the end, rather than lots of standardised tests? But we also go slow with the way that we put things in place. So rather than thinking of this way of teaching and learning and putting it across the whole of the school, we started it in reception, into year one, into year two, into year three. So it's taken us a number of years to get it to where it is. All the time we're doing that, we give teachers time themselves to research what's going on. So whatever we've put in place, is it working? And we actually plan teaching research projects constantly and give teachers time to do that, giving them time to look at international research, doing action research in the classroom, putting the two together, and making decisions on where the teaching and learning is going next. So it's not just in the classroom with children that we take a slow approach. It's across the whole of the school, really. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I find fascinating about the journey that St. Silas has gone on is that it's not only the way the teaching has changed inside the school, but it's the very fabric of the school itself, the building that this is all happening inside. Because you said it was an old school, it was in fact a Victorian school, wasn't
yes.
it? Which brings with it a whole ethos of what education and classroom should look like.
Yes.
And it seems to me, at least, that it welds you into that approach of the chalk and talk and the drill and kill and all those phrases that describe what we could broadly talk of as fast education, I suppose.
Yes.
Or not the opposite of slow education. And so maybe this is a good moment to bring Chris in, because it's the environment, the learning environment is sometimes as important, or it's certainly one of the key factors, isn't it, in
yes.
how children learn and teachers develop and so on. So maybe, do you want to tell me how you came into this story and what you brought okay. to the party?
So in 2010, the local authority had managed to secure central government funding to provide a new primary school on the same site as the original Victorian building, which brought a number of challenges and opportunities at the same time. The opportunity to get rid of what was really quite a miserable, dark, slightly forbidding school that, granted, was part of this community and was one of the first buildings built in this area of Blackburn, but it really didn't work. It certainly wasn't big enough. It was an enormous building, but there wasn't any usable space in it, which is another one of those ironies of that kind of massive architecture, that actually the spaces for learning in were not terribly well lit. They had no view out. They were dark, and they felt private. They weren't really very good for modern education. What we've delivered is a very distinctive building in its place. But actually, the spaces that you go into, those classrooms, are very flexible. They are flooded with natural daylight. Their acoustics and their ventilation are set up in a way that means that they can be used all the year round successfully. And the arrangement of the classrooms and class spaces around a central courtyard creates a heart space in the middle of the school that is accessible to almost all of those classrooms via direct access onto either a courtyard space or onto very wide walkways or rooftop play areas. The site's very small, and as a result, that's one of those challenges. It's actually too small for a primary school. The existing school had very little play area. We've covered every available horizontal surface in play space and stacked up the functionality with there's a five-a-side football pitch on the roof, so that as much of the school is working hard. We said, I remember the conversation we had about every inch working twice. It had to do two things. Nothing could just do one thing. So in terms of slow education and how that ethos is reflected in the school, actually the fundamental changes are in the way that the classrooms are used by the teachers and by the staff and by the pupils themselves. So it's not everybody having a desk. It's a teacher not behind a desk standing, as you said, the chalk and talk thing. Mm-hmm. Because that doesn't happen, and because those spaces interconnect with one another visually as well, so there's a lot of transparent surfaces that connect spaces together, there's a whole school cohesion. And in a classroom, that breaks down into individual activities and group activities and project-based activities. And that was right there from the start. When we first started talking about this school, it was a conversation not about the physical requirement, but about the ambition for the delivery of the curriculum. How you actually deliver learning to a group of children. That's a big... Primary schools are great places because they're such a broad spectrum of ages in such a tiny period of time in your life, you know, between the ages of 4 and 11, 12, you change a lot. Mm-hmm. So actually how you access learning changes a lot, and the building has to be flexible around you, but really it's the teaching staff that deliver that in those spaces.
It's a beautiful building and space, and walking around it is lifts the spirit, I find. You use the word play there, and I find it's the building is light, it's fluid, but it's also playful. There's a very yes. playful spirit here. And play, of course, is a big part, I think, of slow education and channeling the power of play and the wisdom of play and the joy of play. Is that how you saw it in the building of the building? And is that how you see it, Hilary, in the delivery of this curriculum and modern learning?
Yeah, definitely. It is a big, big part of what we do, and giving children that time to be creative. And sometimes it is creative with resources. Sometimes it's just being creative with nothing. And that was really, really important to us, and having those spaces to do that. I think the building is playful, and it is one of the things. I want to come to work every day and have fun. I know the children want to come to school every day and have fun. We know from the research that if children are having fun and they're happy, they're going to learn better. So it is a building that does that. And I think the staff do that very, very well as well. And there are some nice little quirky bits, like it is very colourful. We have a lot of colour in the building. We have the slide linking from one play deck to the courtyard. So there are some quirky bits. And the building does help us with that, but it also helps, it goes back to that dualness of it, that there are spaces where there is frenetic, lively, loud learning taking place, but there are also places where children can go to be quiet, to be peaceful and to be reflective, and I think having that mixture is really good, and it goes back to that slow philosophy again, and we were talking about it last night. You know, sometimes you do need to go fast. And sometimes learning is fast, but sometimes it isn't. And sometimes children need that space to just sit and think, or just sit and do nothing. Mm-hmm. And to be able to have that within a building is great.
That changing of the gears. Yeah.
But also to have staff that understand that and allow for it as well.
And having a culture that permits and fosters that, and a building that allows it to happen, doesn't just occur in schools, is it? I mean, that sounds very much like a Silicon Valley workplace.
Yeah, exactly. My background is in office and workplace primarily, and I work still in doing that now. And I think I approached the idea of classroom, and I'd done some schools before this, all around how does a pupil sit within a space and making the environment as suitable as possible for productive learning in a day. There's some really, really simple things around here. Can you hear the teacher? Are you asleep because there's not enough air and you're just falling out of consciousness after lunch? Can you actually get to everything? There's some physical ergonomic things. But actually that flexibility of the space is very common in workplace. The idea of accessing the workplace in different ways, in different, you know, different people working from home, nomadic workers and desk-based workers, and project-based learning and project-based working is just so similar. I recently went for a tour of King's headquarters that they've just opened up in Soho, who make Candy Crush. And they start every day with a project huddle, which is where they all gather together and they go through the tasks they're going to deal with during the day, and then they separate out. Their desks all move around. And in effect, that office is pretty much exactly what you've got going on in these classrooms now. And that is a more modern way of working. And a lot of big corporations are adopting that flexibility. Silas is also quite clever in the sense that the playful skin around the outside of the building actually hides a very rigorous and very well planned out and very efficient building that was built for a very demanding budget. I've said very way too many times, but a lot of money went into building the building on the site, and actually there wasn't much left to be playful with. So some of the things are just lucky happenstance and tricks the slide. Not a vastly expensive thing to do, but it just adds a little vibrancy to a corner, and it changes the way that the building circulates. So, you know, different people move around the building in different ways.
And the silver cladding, again, wasn't expensive.
No.
And it allowed the school to be very cheaply built,
yeah,
in a way. But the silver cladding, which wasn't expensive either, but then you've got the colourful fins.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, one of the things was that I was really a big part of the design team. That made such a big difference,
yeah,
because we'd got everything going on. And so we've ended up with a school that's really fit for purpose because the design team listened very, very much to the educationalists. And I don't know if you remember, we were sitting in the big room at Capita that one time, and you showed us what it was going to be made of, and the fins and the colour and the silver. And I think I clapped my hands like a little girl and went, oh my God, it's a fairy castle!
Did pupils have any input?
Yes,
yeah,
they had a big input,
mm-hmm,
into all sorts of aspects of it. And Chris and the team came in regularly, and they worked with the staff, and you worked with children. They helped design the playgrounds. So, yes, really, really, really big part,
mm-hmm,
of the whole design process.
I think part of the success is actually the fact that the community of the school are very local to the school. That the parents live within a few hundred yards very often of the location of the school, which means pupils are embedded in the school. The community is wrapped around the school. The response to the idea of building a new building was incredibly positive. We knocked on every single door that overlooks the site. We spoke to everybody. We had no letters of objection at planning, which if you look at the school, you know, from a visual impact point of view, it is quite striking.
Mm-hmm.
but we had letters of support from parents who felt that it was appropriate that they were given a new school that was actually fit for purpose for 420 people. That's a lot of kids to have squished into a tiny area.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to work hard to make that function. So it was really needed. A new school was a great thing to have, but limited resources, limited budget. The cladding on the outside of this building is more commonly used on large out-of-town warehouses and retail distribution buildings. It's incredibly cheap and cheerful.
It doesn't feel that way when you work. It feels lively and...
Yeah, but the veil that we wrapped around it, the whole idea of that was that we would create something that wrapped all the way around the building in an amorphous way so that the whole building appears the same from all angles,
mm-hmm,
and you catch little views of the building as you approach it down streets, which is the only way you really experience it, which means that you're not looking at what's behind those colourful fins, and they change in the light and they change the way that the building looks and feels in its landscape, and they connect back to the colours of the Pennines in the background as well. So there's a couple of visual tricks which enabled us to build a much larger volume on the site than might immediately be expected for the budget that we were given.
I should at this point say that the Pennines are sort of, is it fair to call them mountains? Or
I think so.
Very big hills.
Try walking up them, yeah.
In the background, yeah. When you were describing the vista that people get, I've only just come straight into the school, haven't walked around the neighborhood,
yeah,
but it reminded me a little bit of Bilbao, when you walk around Bilbao and you suddenly look down these little alleyways and catch a glimpse of the glinting,
yes,
Guggenheim Museum. Is that
yeah,
kind of...
We talked about that, and we talked about some other buildings around the world that have the same effect, where it effectively experiencing a building as a pedestrian approaching it is very different to experiencing a building as a designer when you're trying to present it to someone. A lot of designers will show you the view of the building from up above as if you're a pigeon.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really gain you anything. You don't learn from that. It's important to understand what a building looks and feels like to the streets immediately around it. And I think that came out through the public consultations and through... We did an exhibition on site, put panels up, invited everybody in, got the local councillors in, and talked about how the building was going to look and feel. And fair dues to the planning department, actually. They were fantastic and allowed us to proceed with a planning application that was done quite rapidly in a very anti-slow way, but done in a very focused and very concentrated way that got to exactly the right outcome.
Well, the outcome is magnificent, and I should say also that I'm going to put some photos up on the site for people to see.
Great.
What we're talking about. Let's come back to the education and the way it's being delivered in the school at the moment. it all makes perfect sense to me, and I'm sure to many of our listeners. And we were talking just a moment ago about how the way you're getting people to learn, interact here reflects what's happening in modern workplaces. But that doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of obstacles to bringing this kind of education into the real world in here in Britain or in other countries, because there's the system, there are inspectors, there are politicians who have their own way of thinking. What were the big hurdles that you faced putting your vision for teaching, schooling, learning into place in St. Silas, and how did you overcome them?
Yeah, I think initially it was teachers' mistrust, because they didn't, it is change. And I think everybody finds change quite difficult.
What did they find particularly difficult or scary? Was it the ceding of control, maybe autonomy?
Yes, was that exactly it. It was, and as a teacher, I think in a very, you can cut this bit out, can't you?
Yeah, there's no problem.
Oh, the way the boys doing it. What's that word?
To do with what?
Traditional.
Traditional, thank you.
2 seconds.
traditional teaching has been very much about control and the teachers having control of the teaching, and actually learning became very second place, or learning was very second place, where we've sort of flipped it round and it's the learning that is important, not the teaching, if that makes sense. Because actually, you can teach all you want to, but unless the children are learning, then it's not not effective. So it was loosening off that control and believing that actually, if you give the control over to the children, that they will continue to learn, and actually their learning is more powerful and in greater depth.
Did you find that it was older teachers who struggled more with that shift?
No, funnily enough, it wasn't. The older teachers had taught in a similar way when they first started teaching. So when I started teaching, it was just at the end of project type teaching, and teachers were much more fluid. They were much more in tune with what the children wanted to do. And if it was a nice day, they would throw everything out of the window and go and sit outside and on the grass or go on a nature trail. At that time, when you didn't have league tables and sats and all of inspections as they are now, that's how teachers used to teach. And I do understand and I do agree that sometimes that was too unstructured and there wasn't enough emphasis on ensuring children were learning. But the older teachers had done it before. So for them, they actually found it easier than some of the teachers who had been out sort of five to 10 years, because they've only known what we have now.
And maybe they've only known it even as pupils, because when they were in school, they didn't have the project-based open fluid learning. It was all structured.
Yeah. Absolutely. So it was actually those teachers who did find it more difficult. And the other interesting thing is that it was the perfectionist teachers that struggled with it, because they want, and again, goes back to that control. They felt that unless they had the control, that everything wasn't going to be perfect. So it was about being brave, getting, you know, all the things that the children now have as their learner profile. It was getting the teachers to do that first. So take risks. Make sure that if you were expecting people to take risks, then there was a no blame culture. We did a lot of coaching training, so all the teachers and teaching assistants have all had training in being coaches and active listening, so that we were able to support each other in a non-judgmental way. People were allowed to take risks and try things out, and nobody was going to go, oh, that's wrong, and you've done it wrong, and you're in trouble now. So it was building up that culture with the teaching staff, making sure that we were using international research, but rather than just looking at the international research, knee-jerk reaction, doing something in school, it was linking that international research with action research in school, and how do we apply that to our context. So an awful lot goes on around the outside of this approach to learning, and it was taking it slow, it was giving people the time that they needed to make sure that they'd implemented it in a way that made sense to them and worked for them. And some people went faster than others, some people needed more support than others. And we've got to the point now where we have got it going all the way through school, and we're starting again in reception. And in reception, we now have completely child-initiated learning. There is no pre-planning. It is teaching in the moment. It is learning in the moment. And it is really giving over that learning environment to 4- and 5-year-old, as you've seen for yourself today, you couldn't have a class of more engaged learners.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just been great. That's gone really, really well this year. We'll then take elements of that through to year one next year, and we start again.
Are you operating here at St. Silas really as an oasis of slow education in a desert of, you know, fast education, if you like, a system that's enthralled to tests, targets, and timetables, and so on? And how does that dynamic play out? And how can you carry on doing what you do within a system that's pushing in what feels like the opposite direction?
I would love to say no, but I think reality, yes, we are. The good thing is, though, that, again, with the Slow Education Network, we've been able to work with networks of schools in the locality, with schools that aren't at the same point of the journey that we're on, and we've all been able to support each other. So last year we did a network project on project-based learning and teacher research, and six schools worked together. Teachers from the six schools worked together. They worked with artists, and they worked with a university lecturer who helped them to devise research projects. So it's things like that, that although those schools, for them, it was just a project, it wasn't a whole way of being, they've dipped their toe in the water and actually found it was extremely positive experience.
And I'm guessing that that learning between schools is a two-way track, right?
Yes.
Even though you're further down the path, you're still learning from
Absolutely.
The schools that are coming on stream now.
Yeah. Absolutely. And in some respects, you know, the fact that they were doing it just as a project in one or two classrooms, they were able to do what they did in more depth at that point in time, which we've learned from, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So it was really powerful. And the learning that came out of it was really powerful. We're doing a different project in a similar nature, but taking it on a slight different course with two other schools this year, and we've just proposed another larger project with as many schools as we can get involved with for the next academic year. So I think we are a bit of an oasis. People are very, very fearful of the system and of Ofsted.
People as in the staff or parents?
Staff, I think, head teachers particularly. But we've now had two Ofsteds.
I need to clarify for people that Ofsted is the state inspection bureau who come around
yes.
with their clipboards and yeah. And you've had two visits from Ofsted
since we've been working this way, and both of them were very, very positive. We came out with strong goods both times.
Mm-hmm.
And Ofsted liked what they saw. I think head teachers these days are very fearful of the systems. I think they're fearful of losing their jobs. There is a fear culture going on at the moment that does stop people from wanting to be innovative and wanting to take risks. But people do need to be brave. And I think there is a lot of myths out there about what Ofsted want to see. Ofsted want to see happy, successful learners. That's what they want to see. Mm-hmm. They want to see children make progress. And they really are happy to see that. However you deliver it.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes educationalists, head teachers particularly, we are our own worst enemy. We get tied up with fear. Mm. And actually a lot of the things that people are fearful about don't actually exist.
Or are you also saying in a way that however toxic or misguided the system is, you can still make big, big changes within your own school?
Yes, you can. It is getting harder, however, certainly over the last seven, I've been here 10 years now, the last 7 years, it has got increasingly harder because there are so many edicts coming from the DfE.
That's the Department.
Of the Department for Education.
Right.
And some of them are very nonsensical.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a group of people, we try and do the very best we can. We try and do what we're told. And I think sometimes we've got to take the professional attitude and look at it and say, actually, that isn't right. And it isn't right for children. And we're not going to do it, rather than trying to hoop jump all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It is getting harder.
You mentioned international research. Are there particular countries that you've looked at and thought, we'll have a bit of that
Yes. Yeah, when we started looking, we looked particularly, we used the National College for School Leadership website as it was then. And a lot of the schools that we saw that were doing a similar approach were actually in Australia. So we looked at case studies and videos of a lot of the Australian schools.
State schools or private schools?
Mixture. Some state, some were private. We also looked to some of the schools in Europe, and particularly schools where, well, majority of Europe, where children don't actually start formal learning till seven. I went to Hungary and went into kindergartens in Hungary, where children not only are don't learn to read and write, they're actually dissuaded not to. So there is no reading or writing at all in the kindergartens. It's all about social, it's all about developing autonomy, developing confidence,
speaking
and listening, play, experimental, nature, all of that. And they do not learn to read and write at all until they're seven. I then went to the next stage on, and within a year, the children were reading and writing beautifully. So a lot of lessons learned from all sorts of places. And it's not about picking up a system from another country and plonking it in. It doesn't work. You've just got to look and take the best of what you see, and then how will that fit into our context? How can you make it work for us?
Mm-hmm. Now, the kids who are leaving St. Silas and moving on to secondary school, mm-hmm. what is the feedback you get from the schools that are taking them in?
We work very closely with our largest feeder school, which is Witten High School Academy. They have also had a new school built, and they had a similar approach to it. So in year 7 and 8, they have big, open, flexible learning areas, and the children are kept together more in classes than you would see in a lot of secondary schools. So actually our children fare very well when they go through. We also do a lot of work with Witten. Our children work with their children on learning action teams, so they develop research projects within their two schools. The teachers work together, so there's a lot of cross-fertilisation mm-hmm. between the two schools. And the teachers from Witten have come and worked here and have seen what goes on. We actually use some of their specialist teachers, so their DT teacher has come and worked with our year fives on a project where they were building racing cars. That lasted a full term, absolutely fabulous. So, and we can go and use their facilities. So we go and use their science facilities and get children engaged with that and really excited. So lots of joint working does ensure that actually the children go up and they are very successful when mm-hmm. they go up to high school.
And do they stand out as children from St. Silas just because of the
background? Yeah, I don't know that actually. I shall have to do a bit of investigation. Mm-hmm. No, I don't know. We haven't had any complaints.
That's a good starting point,
they're,
isn't
they're
it?
They're very anarchic or don't do what they're told or anything like that. No, I'll do a bit of digging into that. I'm not quite sure. We were going to speak to them about tracking our children through to GCSE and then on to university and see how many mm-hmm. of them access further education. But we're a couple of years down the line from that mm-hmm. yet.
Well, I know St. Silas is a bit of a beacon for schooling. You get lots of visitors coming to see how you do things within your four walls. What about the building itself? I gather it's won some awards and so on. What have you done, Chris? Have you gone on and done other schools? Have other schools or architects you know come and seen what you've done here and incorporated some of your ideas?
I have done some other schools since, and yes, this one was very successful. We won an RIBA National Award for this school, which is the top RIBA award until you get to the Sterling Prize. We're actually mid-listed for the Sterling Prize as well. And interestingly, your response about the school was very similar to their words. It is somewhere that gives you it lifts the spirits and lifts mm. the heart. The education funding landscape has changed considerably. It would be almost impossible to build a school like this now. The money simply isn't there. You certainly wouldn't have the money to enhance the physical use of the site. I don't think that would be even close to where we could get to these days. I think we were very lucky to catch the funding opportunity when we did deliver this. But that doesn't mean to say that the education delivery method can't be applied to schools that are being built now. But it would involve both architects and the contractors that deliver under design and build contracts, these relationship built contracts where the designers are the contractors. They would have to take a lot more time to talk to teachers about the successes of this kind of methodology. It's been a great experience to work on it, and I'd love to do more schools like this. But you also said something about not necessarily copying what happens abroad, but looking at context. And architecture is all about context as well. And I think in the same way that not every school will deliver exactly the same pattern of learning or the same curriculum in exactly the same way in the same classroom spaces, the architectural responses can't be the same all over the country. And unfortunately, the funding model that the government uses now is exactly that cookie cutter methodology to all schools. And that takes away some of that joy and certainly some of the fun. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit disconcerting when the idea of a well-designed and fun primary school is looked upon with a furrowed brow by mm-hmm. those that fund it. I think that's disappointing.
That's a sorry state of affairs, isn't it?
Yeah.
We walked around today and looked. Are there things that you, Chris, see and think, oh, I would do this differently now? Or you, Hillary, and think, oh, now that I see how it plays out in the real world, I might have suggested something different?
Very little for us. I think just practicalities such as the doors at the front, and I know they probably have to, but they open out rather than open in. It's just
for fire reasons.
Our life it has. So just little practicalities like that. But again, because we worked so well together, there is very little that we would change because we were listened to, and maybe because we had a very clear vision.
You knew exactly what you wanted, and you gave me four or five things that on day one were clearly going to be, myself and Altaf Master and Duncan Hamley worked with me, had a clear tick list of the most important things. Mm-hmm. And I think if you get that from a client and you've got a good understanding of where those things are going to lead to, you'll end up with a solution that's pretty good. Every building is unique, which means that there will always be things you go back to and look at and think, possibly that could change, but a building should be, they call it long life loose fit, which means it's adaptable and flexible. Mm. The idea of being able to adapt and change a building afterwards, we have walked around and looked at things, that you might fiddle with, but the core of it, I think I'm very pleased with it.
Yeah, I think possibly the one thing I would have done in hindsight, and particularly in year two, but even further at the school, is replicate the reception in the year one model where you've got two classes together with a much bigger space to play with, because that works beautifully there.
We did start out like that as well.
Yeah, I know. And I think if I had my time over, open plan schools don't work because it is too noisy. You don't get that mixture of quiet and frenetic. But I think to have those year groups, because we are 2-4 entry, to have those year groups together all the way up would have worked for this way of teaching and learning.
A final question, which is about the demographics of the school, because people often hear about slow education and think that probably works best for kids from middle class families where they're getting a lot of enrichment at home. But that's not the setup you've got here, is it? I mean,
no, it's an interesting school because it's a Church of England voluntary aided school, and I think at 90% of our children are Muslim. So it's an interesting school before you've even started, but it is in a fairly built up urban area. The children on the whole don't have a lot of experience outside of school. So once they've finished school, we do a lot of extracurricular stuff, but they are then at mosque for 2 hours every night. And weekends are usually spent indoors. They don't go out of doors a lot. Visits out, they might go to Manchester, they might go to London, or they might go abroad to Pakistan, India, Asian subcontinent, but very little else. So it always amuses us as we set off on the coach to any trip and we get literally step out of Blackburn to where the fields are, and the immediate excitement is sheeps, sheeps, like children have never seen sheep before. So, I sat with a group of year six children last year, and we were talking about sand dunes. They got no idea what a sand dune was. So I said, well, you've seen the sand dunes at St. Anne's. Has anybody been to St. Anne's? Has anybody been to Blackpool? Have you been to the beach? Out of the six of them, only one child had been to the beach. We're 40 minutes away from that beach. So this is the type of children we're talking about. And I would say for this type of child, it's even more important that they actually get an opportunity for hands-on experiential learning, and that we bring as much real life to the classroom, real life experience as we possibly can. It's even more important for these children, I would say, and it works beautifully.
I think that's very true, and it's also something that we should have learnt over the past 40 years of looking at our education building stock, is that if you show a group of pupils that you respect them and you design buildings that are high quality and that they can see are built with an investment that's aimed at them, they will treat them with respect, and they will treat those that teach them with respect, and they will leave with aspirations. If you give them the cheapest solution, then they'll give you back the same kind of response. And what it actually does is just makes teachers' lives even harder, which frankly I don't think they need.
Yeah.
And the one thing I would hope that changes in the future is that we start to look at schools as buildings that our community should be proud of, and that our community should see the investment in schools as a very positive thing for society as a whole. Because there is a society, you can't really avoid that. It is out there, and mm-hmm. it needs help in lots of different ways. One of the great successes, which I will admit was almost accidental, is the fact that when you're up on the top of the school, in that five-a-side football pitch, or in the more senior years classrooms, you're looking out across the rooftops of the town and outside of the city of Blackburn, and I think it helps to give that connectivity, that aspiration, that idea that you're not just down on the streets. Once you've lifted out of the town, you can see further, you can see new horizons. That sounds mm-hmm. awfully cheesy, but you know, I'm delighted to say the RIBA judge that was with us that day said exactly the same thing. That makes a big difference. It gives people hope.
Mm-hmm.
It does. And having a school where it's like the school is in the hub of the community, but it's so outward looking and people can look in, and we take that approach in the education as well. So we do go out of school a lot. So we use the locality. The children regularly go off to one of the two parks that are very, very close to us. We bring the parks in. The parents have access to the school. As you saw this morning, you saw a group of parents staying for coffee at the community cafe. After the children have been dropped off in school. So it's making the most of the building, but it's making the most of the building within the locality and then further afield as well. And just trying to get children to see that actually within walking distance, there's huge amounts. We use Brockholes Nature Reserve. Children can get on a bus on Preston New Road, which is a 2-minute walk from here, and they can be dropped off at Brockholes Nature Reserve. And it's trying to show the parents, the children, what the wealth of learning opportunities, enjoying opportunities there is within this locality. And again, that's a job we take very seriously as a school.
Because that's part of slow education too, isn't it? Is reaching out to community, having parents
Absolutely.
Involved in a healthy way.
Yes.
Not the kind of pushy parent syndrome, but
yes.
parents who are there as, you know, partners in all of it.
Well, our homework, we don't set traditional homework. We have a homework grid that lasts the course of a topic. The grids have six little spaces on it, and in the spaces are activities that we would like the parents to do with their children. And again, it's that same thing. It's taking the learning away from school and ensuring that it goes on all the time and the parents are part of that. So rather than your traditional spellings on a Friday, we do a little bit of that as well. But predominantly the homework grids and the homework is about what children can do with parents or grandparents or aunties and uncles or younger brothers and sisters. And it's an experiential thing rather than a sitting pencil and paper task.
Because of the nature of this neighbourhood and community, you don't, I think, have a lot of proverbial pushy parents, do you?
No, we have some, but no.
And have those ones been feel at ease with this approach to education, or are they a little bit antsy, feeling that their kids are going to get left behind and that slow is a dirty word?
No. Again, we did a lot of work with our parents early doors in explaining it. We had sessions where we have parents come in and we do a lot of parent workshops on a whole range of topics. We also use our VLE, which is a virtual learning environment website, but it's more than a website. We put a lot of DVDs and videos and pictures of the type of things that we do and the learning that takes place. The reception children coming in, we spend a lot of time in the first term before they come to school, working with parents and explaining the systems. We take parents on tours through the school. We use our parent governors an awful lot. When we made the changes going to child-initiated learning in reception, we involve the parents very heavily in that. So they take a big part in the learning of their child when it's their child's focus week. So I think it's communication, it's making sure that everybody has a full understanding. And I've recently, well, just last week, I had a parent, a mum and dad, come to me because I am actually leaving at the end of this term. And they were really concerned when they actually came to see me because they just moved their child at the beginning of September from a local school to our school because they felt that they were being over-tested at the previous school. They liked what they'd heard and saw about here and about the slow education approach. They've moved their children into this school and they were really concerned that if I was leaving, would that all change? So actually our parents really do like it and I think they really appreciate what we do here. You know, I was able to reassure them that actually the school and the governors and staff are very, very committed to continuing with this. And, you know, I know that even if I'm not here, it will continue in this vein. So,
well, that's a very optimistic note maybe to end on. Wonderful. As I started out saying, I mean, just walking around that feeling the spirit lift and thinking, yes, I'd like my children to come. I'd like to be a teacher here. I'd like to just be here, right? Yeah. It's got that feeling to it. So I have to commend you both. It's been great. Thank you.
And that's where the interview ended. Hope you enjoyed the program. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to send them along through the contact page on my website, www.carlhonore.com. And if you have suggestions for other people you'd like to hear interviewed on the Slow Revolution podcast, send those along too. Thanks again for listening and catch you next time.